fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app.
Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey Blenders, it's Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend and a co-host of the Road Blend podcast. And it is Friday and I am flying solo. We are taking the week off for a couple different reasons. It's the end of the summer, but specifically the DNC is happening in Chicago. So Jake is swarmed by that. It's essentially all hands on deck at his network. A couple of guys are going on vacation, but we don't want to leave you guys without some fresh content for you. And so on behalf of The Crow, we have director Rupert Sanders coming by to talk about his remake with Bill Skarsgård. This is a film that's been in the works for a long time now. It went through a couple of different iterations as well, too. We saw at one point Jason Momoa was going to lead this reboot. Would have been a very, very different take on this if it was someone as hulking as Momoa. Because instead, I think this movie really does play into the physique of Bill Skarsgård, who people probably best know as Pennywise from the It adaptations, part one and part two. But is really a chameleon of an actor who disappears into this role of Eric. Classic role from not just the graphic novels, but the original film that starred Brandon Lee. And we do talk to Rupert about his interpretation of Brandon Lee and how much he thought about Brandon Lee when bringing this to life. We talk a lot about the making of the film, of course, as we tend to do on the Road Blend podcast here. Some stuff about the Foley editing, specifically the sound of this film is pretty gnarly. And if you know The Crow and if you know the powers that come with the reincarnation abilities of the person who has the supernatural powers of The Crow, you can imagine the kind of fun that Rupert had with his team in putting this together. I do want to sort of mention, this is a spoiler-free conversation. It's something you can listen to before you head into the movie. We do a little bit towards the end of the very end of the interview. Last question, I saved a detail about some stuff that happens at the end. Not really spoilery, but I make it very clear in the interview before we get into that part. So if you get that far, then you want to bail out before checking out The Crow, then feel free to do so. But otherwise, the rest of this should be plenty safe for you guys to listen to. So it's Rupert Sanders, the director of the reboot of The Crow, new Real Blend interview for you guys in lieu of a full show, but we still want you guys to have something. So here's Rupert Sanders joining the Real Blend podcast.
Geek away.
Yes, I want to start with this. The story doesn't work unless the audience buys into Eric and Shelley, obviously, as a couple. And you give them an ample amount of time to develop their relationship. But I want to talk about the amount of time you gave your actors before you rolled camera to form a bond, to create something that was palpable on the screen, because it really comes through. And I was just curious about some of the exercises you might have gone through with them to sell that bond as much as you can.
I mean, I think sadly, like, you know, actors usually arrive and a couple of days later you're shooting, you know, you don't have the kind of the great theater rehearsal time. I was very lucky that both Bill and Twiggs just like, I didn't do any chemistry reads. I cast them both. I was very sure of them together, but I didn't really know the magic until we started rolling. We shot some kind of, I wanted to ease them in. So we did this scene by the lake, which was kind of a little bit documentary. They're just kind of meant to be hanging out. And like, you know, they were sitting and smoking weed and swimming in the lake and kissing and just chatting. So there was no like scene in a way, but it was reassuring because instantly, like when the cameras rolled and it switched, they both were in there. And I was like, wow, they're really like, there's something really tingling about these two. And I didn't know because I didn't like, I had dinner with Bill and Twiggs and I left there going, you know, like a kind of proud parent, like, yeah, I think my kids are getting along pretty well, but I didn't really know until we rolled camera. And Bill was exceptionally, you know, he is, you know, a born actor. He's been through it so much more than Twiggs, and Twiggs, I think, looked to him to kind of help. So I think the three of us just had a really nice bond together where we were all supporting each other. You know, it's a difficult process, as you know, filmmaking. We had difficult hours. We were shooting mainly nights. And so it's, you know, it's nice to have that kind of nucleus of kind of creative bonding at the center of it.
Just to really briefly touch on that, it wasn't until, you know, during the second half of the movie where you do flash back to some of the earlier brighter moments where I realized, oh, those really, that's like an oasis in the, you know, those moments that you had to film in the sun where they're enjoying their lives.
It's funny, our first day was like Prague and I think it was like July. And actually it was a really unsunny, beautiful day. It was quite gray and rainy. And you know, you're so scheduled that it's not like, oh, we'll come back another day. It's like, this is it. So, you know, it's as sunny as you guys make it. And yeah, it became kind of a seminal part of the movie, that little, you know, that little scene. But I really wanted that lightness at the beginning. I wanted to invest in their love. You know, to me, it is it's a dark romantic love story. It's like a Cure song, as James O'Barr describes his book, you know, and without that emotional core, I don't think the movie really succeeds, as you said.
Yeah, true.
Rupert, I want to talk about those the early conversations that you had with Bill, specifically because he's tackled so many roles that other people have played in the past, whether it be obviously in this film or with Pennywise or Nosferatu coming up. So whenever you officially bring him on and you start having those conversations about this character, how long into your back and forth does it take before the name Brandon Lee comes up? Like, is that something you guys talk about right off the top? Do you need to talk about it at all?
No, we didn't actually, because I don't think Bill comes into a character thinking about who played him before. I don't think it works that way in theater either. You know, I think you come in, you look at the text and you go, this is the character. And also our character's wildly different. I mean, obviously, you know, it's funny. I don't think we were as aware of that movie as much as we have been made aware of it after making our movie in a way, because that seems
to an annoying degree.
No, it's just I understand it, in a vacuum of information, people all, you know, they make their own assumptions, you know, usually without, you know, really the understanding, which is what happens. You know, I think that probably, and we saw the change just as stuff started to trickle out, and you know, that you started to see the younger audience being like, oh no, this looks amazing. This is the movie for us, kind of thing. And it was all people who are my age who was like, oh, you don't want to do that. Oh, you know. But yeah, Bill, you know, Bill and I went through, you know, documentaries on like kids growing up on the streets and like self-tattooing and going in and out of foster homes and rehab. And we really found that kind of, you know, way in to Eric from that. You know, it's very much based on my experience and his experience of being around that kind of thing and seeing those, knowing those kind of characters. And then, you know, what's great about Bill is he's got this incredible tender empathy, but he's also got this ability to be, you know, terrifying. And I think he likes to embrace those dark characters. And he's a very physical actor. He really likes the physical side of the performance. And I think, you know, he's not the actor who in a stunt sequence, you know, to him, a stunt sequence is a monologue. You know, in the opera sequence, he's fighting his way up the stairs, but you see on his face that he is performing, he is emoting, he is making us care, he is making us cry, he is making us weary. He's not just like letting the stunt guy do everything and then just popping up and going, and then going back out of frame. You know, he is like, it's a performance to him. And I think that's what's great about Bill. And, you know, on the last night of shooting, I had this like idea of like, I needed a title sequence. And I'm like, I'm sure it could be some good stuff for the dark dreams at the end of like, there's this big tub of black oil. It's cold. I know it's 2 a.m. and we're like the last guys on set, but would you mind getting in it naked and thrashing around and swallowing it and spitting it out? And he was like,
that's a big ask, man.
Yeah. Looked at me and was like, sure. And he just gave me his towel and got in. And that's Bill, you know,
Is that for the title sequence? Oh, that title sequence is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like it cost a lot on a lot of VFX artists, but it was just a slow motion camera and Bill in some black oil.
Oh my God, that's incredible, because it does. It looks like a complete visual effect or something built in the computer.
We didn't have the money for that, I can assure you. We were counting crows, literally, as we worked through the post-production. We're like, do we really need a crow in that background? And then why do we have to have that? You know, it's like we made a very frugal movie that I hope stands up in the IMAX cinema as a big movie. But it was, you know, I think the beauty of it is that we had we had kind of creative control to a degree because we're R-rated, because it's a dark love story with kind of ultra violence and drugs and sex in it and stuff, which is not normally how you get a film that scale made, you know? So sure. It's a rarity.
Yeah. Okay. I'd love to follow up really quickly because to your point, I interviewed an actor one time who was playing a role that had been previously played in another film. And I asked about the other actor and he said, you know, he goes, I've played Hamlet before and no one ever asks me about all the other actors who have ever played Hamlet. Do you think that movie fans make a bigger deal about other people playing the same part than we have in the history of acting? Because to your point, it's been happening for hundreds of years, and only recently do we make a huge big deal when someone else plays Batman, when someone else plays James Bond. Like, is it a recent thing you find?
Well, I just think probably theater goers aren't really, like, you know, keyboard assassins at home, you know, as much as genre movie fans are. So look, it's just part and parcel of it. If you listen to the noise in any of that, in a you know, let it, you know, sway anything, you know, you'd be mad. So, you know, look, it's good that people talk about these things, and it's it helps, you know, generate, you know, intrigue to the movie. So it's not something that worries me or troubles me. And I think, you know, there's new interpretations. It's like, you know, when Christian Bale turned up to set, Chris didn't say, oh, here's Michael Keaton's bat suit, just like, put it right on, and here's the car, and off you go. You know, it's like, our job as filmmakers is to reinvent stories that people love. And, like, you know, I don't think people were screaming at Chris. Well, in fact, I know Chris Nolan, he was, you know, I know that he went through a lot of grief when he cast Heath Ledger, and everyone was like, oh, it's terrible, you know, who is this guy? No, and then, you know, now he became the seminal Joker. So it's, you know, like, I think we just got to move on and be creative and you know, be lucky in a way that people like Bill are not put off by that and turn up to do amazing work and really, you know, I think will change the dynamic of him as an actor. But also, I think when people watch the movie, they'll want to go back and look at the graphic novel and look at the earlier movie to see what, you know. And so I think that's a good thing. And I think we should all be, as filmmakers, congratulating each other on constantly, you know, creatively investigating material. Mm-hmm. That's our job.
Rupert, you mentioned the self-tattooing, and I was fascinated by the choices for the tattoos on Eric. Can you talk about some of the conversations and maybe some of the specific ones that you guys landed on
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of, you know, I think there was, to us, the tattooing was a kind of, for someone who's like broken and shy, the tattooing was a way of saying, keep away. Like, I look scary, don't come and talk to me, which is a big psychology of that kind of tattooing. And then, you know, on his back, he's got a piece of The Raven, Edgar Allan Poe, which meant a lot to Bill as he was reading that stuff to get into the character. Some are just goofy and stupid, and my friend calls them twatoos. Because they're just silly and like people, it tells a history of, like, you know, some were done by other people, some were done professionally, different colors. You know, it's hard to make movie tattoos look right. And I think that he looks great in them, you know. And I think his kind of aesthetic is very true to that character. It's certainly true to the kind of characters I grew up with in that kind of space, you know. And I think there's an honesty to that. And I think it's very true to the Eric we were trying to portray.
They're going to be studied by cosplayers. Like, it's very important to cosplayers as they try to put that together.
It is, but I don't want to answer everything for them. They've got to do a bit of work.
Yes, very true.
There's a fan expo happening. I'm talking to you from Chicago, this weekend, and it would not surprise me to see even before the movie comes out, to see some guys out there dressed up.
No, I'm sure. There's a lot of cool fan art and stuff that's being generated, so it's good to see.
Where do you recommend they get their trench coat from?
Well, the trench coat is a kind of interesting one because Kurt and Bart, who I've worked with a lot, we did Foundation together, we did Ghost in the Shell together. We wanted it to be a kind of emotional, it had to be part of Shelley. It had to be him wearing a part of Shelley. And when they take it off after they've been up onto the roof, it falls inside out and then it's laying down inside out. And so when he puts it on, it's inside out. So you can see the the label on the lapel that should have been inside, and everything is inside out. So the crow coat is actually an inversion of the regular coat.
Oh, that's interesting. It's
supposed to kind of mean that he was wearing, in a way, like that moment that they shared together through the movie.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Wow. That's cool. Rupert, this is never a comparison that I ever thought I would make in an interview, but I would like to compare the character of the crow to that of Snow White, because you are coming at a character that, whether it be through different cinematic versions and through different literary versions, people feel like they have a relationship with. But to your point, you're giving us different versions. You're giving us a different perspective of something that we think we know, but then we look at it and go, oh, that's interesting. I've never thought of it like that before. Is there a common thread between your experience on Snow White and your experience here, in that you're giving us a different version of a character we already thought we knew?
Yeah, look, I think it's there's something interesting to exploring other facets. And actually, going back to the source material in Snow White, I read a lot of the original fairy tales, and the Grimm's fairy tales are pretty grim.
They're awesome.
A lot of that darkness of what the pagan belief system was, and what they were scared of, and the symbolism of the dark forest and the prick of blood. All of those things had so much more meaning if you do the research. And the same with the crow and crows, and how crows in all religions are carrions between the two worlds, or they're harbingers of death and loss. Sometimes they're malign, and sometimes they're friendly guides. So it's, and they're fiercely intelligent crows. So it's just, to me, it's an exploration of source material as a kind of, as though you're an English student. You don't just read it. You have to go through it and study each sentence, and then you do your research and, oh, where did this come from? Where did James O'Barr pull those ideas from? What did that mean in the Native American mythology of the carrion bird, So I'm just going to shut the window one sec.
Sure. There's a crow trying to get in.
Yeah. God, wouldn't that be amazing?
We were hoping a crow was trying to get in.
Yeah, pecking at my window again.
It'd be kind of amazing.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Rupert, I want to get into the really sexy conversation of Foley work, because there's sounds in this film that I'm never going to forget. Specifically, well, of one, I just want to talk to you about the importance of that in general to what you were trying to conceive. But then one in particular is the sound of a leg being put back together.
After that took a while.
can you talk about your process there?
Yeah, look, I think, I think sound to me is such a huge part of filmmaking. And it's amazing when you watch something without the proper sound and how much sound adds to it. We work with a great company called Sonic Ventures in England, and they really, we wanted to amplify the sounds a bit more than just reality and grit and gristle and ligaments and bone and stuff are really good to add the violence into things. And I wanted it to be visceral, but also to be kind of abstracted. We worked a lot just with like the sound of the voice in the kind of the underworld, the Kronos world, of how that kind of moved around the space. How when Eric spoke, 3 minutes later, we'd hear his voice, because the space is kind of it doesn't react to proper, cathedral dynamics. Mm-hmm. So yeah, sound is such a huge part. And I think sometimes it's very important for me as a director to be involved in all of those parts, to sit during the composition of the score, to sit during the sound design, to really push that. My editor, Neil Smith, is kind of like Walter Murch in that way, really like sound. He's obsessive about sound, and I think it does make a huge difference, and it's another way of pushing you into a world in a very visceral way.
There's one I would love for you to comment on a little bit more, which is Danny Houston's voice.
Yes.
How did you come about that? That must have been complicated to find.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of kind of reverb tests, and Danny is really game for anything. Like, Danny loved like the scene where he's like, you know, drinking the black oil out of Bill. He had like cuts on him. He had a jug of black blood and a jug of red blood. He's gargling and spewing, and then he carries the same kind of childlike wonder into the voice. He won't just like, you know, step off set and do a quick couple of lines. He'll like really work at it. And he learned a lot of Latin, a lot of French, and he found all these great like uses. He's got such a great timbre to his voice, but it's got a lot more range. And I think he's, you know, so it was really good for him. And he really like, he'd always laugh that big kind of, you know, when he'd done something that was really horrific. He was like, he's great. He's a incredible actor, and you know, the devil, when you meet the devil, they're wildly seductive and charismatic and offer you everything you want. They're not like evil, and you know, and that was really where Danny and I found that character needed to exist.
Absolutely. Yeah, I almost feel like getting him is half the battle.
Yeah, no, he's great. He was a wonder to work with.
I love whenever I hear stories about actors making decisions or doing things on set before production in hopes it'll have a ripple effect and will end up on the screen. One of my favorite stories being Bill Skarsgård on the set of It made an attempt to avoid the kids so that the first time they saw him, there would be a sort of a genuine shock or fear or terror in their eyes. Was there anything that he did with this character in the hopes that that there is sort of that ripple effect? And if I do this off set, maybe this will end up on the screen.
I'm trying to think. I think the It story is so kind of hard to beat, really, in a way. But
and they're wildly different characters too, different circumstances.
I think it was just interesting watching Bill. Like when we just did obviously you'd start the process of makeup tests and wardrobe tests and hair tests quite early. So Bill had a kind of clipped in hair piece and some slightly shoddy version of the makeup and just a store bought coat, and it was like looking a bit oof. You know, and the tattoos weren't great yet, but then he just started to like, you know, to sit and move in a kind of like in a slightly bird-like way, but just watching him just looking at himself in the mirror and start to like present, you know, some of the things he'd obviously been thinking about as to how to portray that. And then I remember when he came into the room with Danny, he just did a couple of these little like sideways looks that were very like bird-like when he kind of came in, and these little stilted moves that I remember seeing him like tensing in the mirror, you know, in the kind of pre-prep. And then, you know, the next time you see him, the wardrobe's a bit more refined, the wig's better, and gradually he kind of goes into the character, you know, which was really great. And I actually, it's funny because I'd hang out with Bill on the weekend. I was like, he'd turn up and he'd just be in his like, you know, no tattoos and a kind of nice press shirt. And I'm like, I think I prefer you as Eric, Bill. You're just a bit like cooler. I'm like the tats and the mullet and the shaved sides and stuff. But he's a lovely man, Bill. We got on very well together. He's an exceptional partner.
So this might be a silly follow-up, but like whenever you have an actor like that who is sort of making these decisions in advance or maybe even in the moment, is your job almost that of like a documentarian where it's just sort of like, okay, we didn't plan on this, we didn't talk about it, but like I got to capture it because I might not ever get this again?
Yeah, I think, you know, look, I think that's part of that process that, you know, director and actor need to go on together. Like there's rehearsal and then there's just conversation. And you know, I think a lot of the communication that Bill and I had in the run-up was rehearsal in a way, so that when we got to set, we both had a really deep understanding of who the character was and some of those things that he was already thinking about how to play and what to play were already kind of gestating early on. And I think it's, you know, I think it's not so much that you have to grab it there and then, it's all part of finding the edges of the character. And I think then you're like, you know, when you did that thing yesterday, right at the end, I think that would be the way to like come into this scene. And so it's, you know, I think you want an actor who's constantly, I don't know whether you've ever seen a fashion shoot, but if you've got someone who's just standing against the white wall and they're like, you know, click, click, but then you see a great model and they're like moving and showing. And it's like, that's what you want as a photographer. It's the same with the filmmaker. You want to see those things so that you can kind of dial it in with them. And that's like, I think a really, you know, the way that Bill and I found to work together was like, he'd offer lots of stuff up and then we'd find like what made the most sense for that scene or that character in that moment.
And Rupert, in terms of your process, do you feel more comfortable knowing when you have as much as you need later on for the edit? Or is that something that you're still playing around with? Is it totally different from movie to movie?
I think you always try and shoot as much as you possibly can in the time you have. You know, you never, you know, I think I always cover a lot more angles than probably I would need. But then some days you're like, we've just got no time. We're just going to do this as one shot, you know? And so it's kind of like the beauty of coverage is that you can change the dynamic of a scene editorially. But sometimes, you know, just coming on set and being forced into making a decision economically actually turns out to be a great way of covering the scene that actually you wouldn't have had if you got 5 days. Why would you just do one shot, you know? So it's like in 5 days you've got it and you got it, but if you've only got 5 hours, then you're like, well, this has got to be just from his perspective. And that sometimes is the bravery of the scene that is, you know, what you should have done if you had 5 days, but you only had 5 hours, so you did it, you know.
True. Good point.
You use your, like, you know, the limitations as the things that become exceptional, you know?
Yeah. It seems entirely plausible that there's no other version of this movie other than to make it with an R rating. Like, it seems like it's The Crow and it has to be rated R. That being said, it doesn't mean that a bean counter somewhere up there in accounting on a movie studio wouldn't say, well, you know, if we made a PG-13, then maybe we could get, you know, X more. Was it ever a battle on your part to keep it R, or did you always have that support?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're always having to make decisions, making a film to be responsible to the budget and to be able to, like, you know, you want as wide an audience as possible to see it at the other end. But I think, you know, the producers were very open to this being an R-rated movie. And I don't know whether it would have excited me as much as it did if it wasn't. But I don't think it's gratuitous. And actually Lionsgate were great when they came on board. They were like, you know, they were never like, well, if you cut all these things, we could have a PG movie. Because I think because it's The Crow and because it's kind of, it's set in its own territory. We're not trying to assimilate into other things. This is The Crow. It's emotional. It's an emo movie. It's dark. It's gothic. It's a wild ride. You know, that doesn't exist in the other mainstream movies because all the bean counters have said you've got to be this, this, and this if you want to be a four quadrant movie. We're a fierce one quadrant, maybe two quadrant movie, and we're happy with that. You know, The Crow is not for everyone, but for those people it is for, it's really for them. And I think it'll be a movie that really stays with those kids as, like, some of those movies of our childhood did, you know. And I think it's that's what I'm excited for.
That's awesome. I want that on the poster. We are fiercely two quadrant movie. If you like it, come see this.
Why make a film that everyone, it's just, you know, it just doesn't make sense, you know, because you get into those situations where, you know, you have something that's unique and then someone takes an edge off there, an edge off there, an edge off there. And by trying to please everyone, you end up pleasing no one, I think. Sure. And I think the beauty of this film is it is an auteur movie. It's very driven by, you know, emotionally what I was dealing with, having gone through grief and loss and love and all of those things. That was a very personal movie. And, you know, I think people like Crow, Hollywood remake, what a disaster. It's, you know, we made this film purely independently, purely outside of the Hollywood system. We're not a studio movie. We made it in Prague. We made it in London. We made it in Munich with a Czech, German and British film crews. And that's what this movie is. It's not, you know, it's not the worst case scenario for what people, I think, when they heard, oh, no, it's going to, this is, you know, this is what this is going to be. It's not. I think it's really made with love and passion by a lot of, you know, very innovative and gifted people, you know. And it takes a long time. It's 3.5 years of love and passion goes into every frame of this movie. That's why you never really want to watch your movies ever again, because you're spent. You're like, I can't see it again. It's like, it's too harrowing.
All right. They told us we have time for one more, and I saved this for the very end. So if people want to punch out now, go watch The Crow. and then come back and listen to this conversation, because we have to talk about the Opera House sequence and just the conversations you potentially had with the ratings board. Were there certainly
enough? Not many. I think we were quite I think we were quite okay. Weirdly, I mean, you know, it's crazy the things you can do sexually, but you can't, or you can do with violence, but not sex. You know,
that's insane. Because, well, then did you leave extra time to did you spend the most time on that sequence? Did you did that take the most choreography?
No, I mean, I think weirdly enough, it was kind of, I think that, you know, I had big aspirations for the scene. I found the piece of opera, Robert Le Diable, which is a very famous French opera, which is also kind of mimics our story. It's another kind of Greek tragedy about a couple being pulled apart and the devil and heaven and hell. So it kind of is our movie in an opera. Mm-hmm. And then transposed to that, you've got... Eric, who is basically from the gutter, who is now in those places where his type should never be. And it also shows like the humanity's great creative triumph is like this beautiful opera, beautifully choreographed with amazing resonant sounds, which is the apex of what we're capable of. And then you've got like the super violent, guttural, you know, bowel spilling darkness that we're also capable of. And they kind of eclipse each other. And by the end, you know, the music, talking about sound design, the music starts ranged in the opera. And then gradually the opera music becomes the soundtrack to the ultra violence of Eric making his way up the staircase, slicing and dicing. But also Bill stops at the end of one of the pieces and there's just tears in his eyes that he doesn't want to kill anymore. You know, it's like he knows what he's becoming and he's fearful of it, but he knows it's the only way to win her back is to go through. And I think that's really beautiful. Like I said earlier, you know, it's Bill is there in a monologue. He's in a monologue of motion and emotion. And I think that's really rare because he's there for 5 days with us battling up that staircase. And actually, I don't think you ever set out to like, oh, we're going to do something like iconic. You just do your stunt viz, you do your storyboarding, you prep it, you put it on its legs. You're like, oh, what if he did that? And Adam Horton is a great British stunt coordinator. And he'd done, I think, The Witcher. So he'd done quite a lot of good sword stuff. But, you know, Bill came in and rehearsed it. And you know, I think it's really Bill. You know, I think when Bill does things in that are ultra violent and he's deadened in some areas. I think he is what really makes the sequence. It's an actor's performance in motion, really.
It's incredible. Rupert, thank you for taking the time to open up about this movie. We're really excited for people to see it. And we appreciate you coming on as a guest, man. You're welcome back anytime.
Lovely. Well, I greatly appreciate you both. Thanks, Jake. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you. We appreciate you.
Take care. Enjoy Chicago and we'll speak soon.
Will do. Take care, buddy.
Take care.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much to Rupert Sanders for coming on the show. He is welcome back anytime. The Crow is heading to theaters. And when you guys check it out, hit the comments down below. Let us know what you think of the remake. I wanted to sort of time stamp the conversation that we might have had with a full episode. Alien Romulus kicking butt at the box office, but proving to be really divisive. I want to hear from you guys down below as well, too. Heard from a lot of people on social media. I went very positive in my review. Heard a lot of negativity from people who did not agree. Totally cool. The Alien franchise tends to be a little bit polarizing. Whether you like the headiness of the Prometheus Covenant bit, I think there's no questioning that the first two films are masterpieces, but some people feel like this one was a little bit more derivative. So it's a conversation starter, and I kind of love that about Romulus, and I hope more people go check it out at the box office and go see it in the IMAX format. We did have Fede Alvarez on the show, so go back and maybe re-listen to that interview if you had a chance to go see Romulus. He gives some great in-depth conversations about that massive character return and also just the reemergence of Kaylee Spaney as someone who is going to be worth talking about. David Johnson as well, too, getting a lot of buzz for his performance in that. So definitely go back and listen to Fetty while you're here. Thank you very much for coming to check out Rupert Sanders on behalf of The Crow. We got a couple of things in the hopper coming up. I'm heading to Toronto for some big reviews and interviews that come up from there. The boys will be back, of course, as we get into movies like Transformers 1, and a few other big things coming in September. So keep it right here on the Real Blend podcast. If you're on the YouTube channel, hit subscribe, turn on your notifications. We'll drop new episodes on Fridays. Share the show and the channel with a movie-loving friend of yours who wants to hear more conversations with filmmakers like this, and keep it here on Real Blend. We'll be back very soon with a brand new episode for you guys to enjoy.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.